I am a storyteller. Now, I say storyteller instead of liar, because there's a heap of difference between a storyteller and a liar. See, a liar, that's somebody taking cover things over, mainly for his own private benefit. But a storyteller now, that's somebody which you take an uncover thing so everybody can get some good out of it. I'm a storyteller.
You're listening to Word of Mouth, a conversation in three parts investigating America's narrative tradition. Today's program, the second in the series, focuses on the South, tracing the role narratives play in our families and communities, and asking, are we losing our stories? We will be visiting Jimmy Turner's Barbershop in Addison, Alabama, an H-Mass store in Valley Crucis, North Carolina. We will talk to John O'Neill, Gurney Norman, Doug and Frankie Quimby, and Elliot Wigginton, among others.
I met this man named John Back, who was a musician, I guess, about a year ago. And when I first met John, the thing that attracted me to him was storytelling. And he told me the story about the Eldridge family up on Kings Creek. It's your typical Lazy Mountain story about the Lazy Mountain man and his children. I mean, it could be, I'm sure there's 50 versions of it, but John swears they live on Kings Creek and they're the Eldridge family. And he said that the Eldridge family wanted to get rid of their dog and they tied sticks of dynamite to their dog and the dog ran underneath the house and blew the house up and blew the stove through the roof. Now, he told me the story last May. And the end of January, I went to a honky-tonk in Hazard to hear John sing. My car doors froze. And so I went in, and all the men at the bar was out there trying to work on it and trying to fix it, and nobody could do it. And so I decided to call the garage, and it was in the middle of the night, and this is rural America, and there's not garages open. And so the only garage I could find open, the name of it was The Highwayman, which is this ex-motorcycle gang's garage. So I called him and I said, you know, I'm down here at the Wooden Nickel at the bar, my car doors are frozen and I want to go home. Can you all send somebody down here to help me figure out how to get my door open? So I'm standing out there, it's ice cold and I have pumps on and I have to get this woman in the bar to give me her shoes so I can take these pumps off and my feet won't freeze on. So I'm out there and I'm trying to cope with this whole situation. Well, in slides this Pinto and I mean it literally slid sideways in the parking lot. Shoom, shoom. I was like, somebody's gonna lose it. Well, out gets this man and he slides. And so he finally gets over to me and he looks at me and he says, are you the woman with problems with your car? And I was like, oh God, this is the man that's gonna work on my car. So he's up there working and he was talking to me and I told him I lived in Whitesburg and stuff and he's talking a little bit more and he looks over at me and he says, do you know the Eldridges up on Kings Creek? I mean, the whole visual impact in my head was that story of the dog blowing up. I mean, that was the whole thing in my head. And he said, that's my family. So that's how a story will come back around to you eventually.
I read a lot of short stories or hear people tell stories who are friends of mine or people I've heard tell stories. The best ones I've ever heard, or most of the best ones, are from the South, but I don't know why.
And I don't know why. I think it's part of it's the idiom, part of it's the expressions they use, part of it's the phrasing, the pausing, the intonations, you know.
When it come the 15th of November, you could expect the snow. I woke up of a morning, and when that hoot owl hollered up there on that cliff, I'd have to shovel out that door there. If that hoot owl hollered, and I could hear that train blow fur as it would again, way the air was a-gone, I knowed what was a-come, that I better drag some wood off of that cliff and get wrecked. And I know the snow was a-come, and them animals and birds know.
One that just comes to me was a funny time when the dog had been chained to the clothesline in the backyard because neighbors were coming. Then the dog was forgotten and left there all day and was suffering and whining. And Grandma looked out the back door and saw the dog out there, and she said, Gurney, honey, give that dog some water. It's a punishing. the dog was punishing. And so that's just, see, that's her language. And in that phrase, I recover the whole sense of my grandmother and her remarkable speech and her wonderful spirit. I get her back. The living presence of the past is a stabilizing and nourishing force, and I draw my identity from it. And it is like a little secret survival kit that I carry with me through the modern world.
It seems that those mountains had a way of holding people in a wonderful kind of way, in a mother's arms kind of way, and also of keeping other things out.
There wasn't no roads here when I was growing up.
I remember when I was going to school, what few days it did go.
My grandparents are illiterate. Tony's parents, I'm second generation literate. He's first generation literate. So if they couldn't read, they had to talk.
We are a region of storytellers, and we are a region of close-knit families, and we are a region of big talkers.
Step right up, ladies and gentlemen. Don't be bashful. The medicine show is about to begin. Come one, come all.
Part of it is the emphasis in the South on what I call the rhetorical aesthetic, which is a fancy term for an emphasis on and an appreciation of skill with the spoken word.
It's made of roots, herbs, barks, morphine, kerosene, benzene, golden seal, wild cherry, buckeye, and sarsaparilla.
Preaching, political, and legal oratory are part of this tradition. The filibuster, for example, grows out of this emphasis on skill with the spoken word. And storytelling is at the center, I think, of this rhetorical aesthetic.
Now, this is good liver medicine. I know it's good liver medicine because my grandma was a walking testimony of the liver medicine. Now, she had one of them livers that quivered from the day that she was 33 years old. But when she died, thanks to this wonderful tonic 70 years later, when she died, the undertaker had to take her liver out and beat it to death with a stick.
Partly this may have had to do with the physical isolation of families in a kind of dispersed settlement pattern, the relishing of company when they had visitors.
You know, swapping visits, swapping tales, and all that is part of the cement because it reinforces a sense of usness.
It locates you in a place, mm-hmm. gives you a history. In that place, in that time, in that community of people, it's central to what you are.
The act of nodding your head in the middle of one of those sessions means, yes, I not only understand and appreciate that story, but I also understand that it also means that I'm part of Raven County now, you know?
Yeah, that's part of it, all right.
To a certain extent also, economics, the lack of a strong economic base to support aesthetics in material culture, that is lavish decorative arts in the Deep South. Particularly after the Civil War, self-entertainment has been a very important approach here in the South.
I guess if I could be a child again and just had one evening to live over, what I'd want to do is to be at home in the farmhouse in the north end of Murray County, Georgia. Some summer evening, lying out on the porch, listening to the big folks talk.
They would just sit on the porch and tell all kind of stories and scary stories, and some of them was actually true stories.
And you know, the porch was not like a deck now, a patio, or a terrace. I mean, the porch was on the front. So you could see what was going on. Didn't want to miss anything. Might have something more to talk about.
The South, up until fairly recently, has had a fairly steady and homogeneous population. And so families tend to have long histories. Communities of families tend to have long histories. And so there are stories to tell and people there who stay there to remember them and to tell them and to pass them on.
In the evenings after supper, we sat in the north room around the fire in the winter. And someone would start to tell about the old times. That was one of my favorite things, was listening to my grandfather tell about what he called the olden times.
I was born in Martin County, Kentucky. I started working in the coal mines 50 cents a day.
50 cents a day was top thing. And then it went on in my time and was a dollar a day, 10 cents an hour. Get a George Washington and boys, they worked you hard. They didn't let no grass grow under your feet.
And I wrote this song at Hard Creek and Black Mountain Hill, you know. I'm going to the Hard Creek Mountain, going back on over my mountain hill. I'm going to fight for the Union, 'cause I know it's Mother Jones's will. And I know it's Mother Jones's will. Children were laying in their tents while they on a...
It's like putting down roots. It's like making webs. It's like, you know, roots get entangled with one another, for crying out loud. And you don't pull them apart. Not very successfully. Well, you can, but then there's a big hole missing.
I can remember falling asleep at night on my great-grandfather's chest. And I would get into bed with him and fall asleep, and he would be talking stories at night. And the first thing I would hear in the morning when I woke was him talking, telling me something.
My daughter, when she was 5 years old, said to me, "Mommy, would you tell me where I came from?" And it was one of those evenings that I had worked all day long, and I thought, oh no, I have to sit here and figure out the real true facts. I said, "Do you want to hear the truth?" And she said, "No." And I said, "Okay." I said, "I was looking for a baby. And I'll tell you the truth, I didn't know what I wanted. So I read the paper one evening, and it said they were having a big closeout sale at Salisbury Memorial Hospital on the late model babies. And they would have them all there about November 27th. So I went down there on the day that they opened the ward for the sale. And I looked on the bottom shelf and all these new boxes, they were real pretty and everything, blue ones and pink ones. And I started opening the boxes, I said, but all the ones on the bottom shelf were too fat. And I put them all back. And then on that second shelf, they were too light-skinned, they were white. And I thought, now I don't think I want a white one. So I went on the next shelf, and these on the next shelf, they was all too black. They were pretty, but they were just not the right color. And it just one right after the other. I said, they were all real nice, but they just didn't catch my interest. And there, when I was getting ready to leave, up on the top shelf in this box that was slightly bent and broken and torn, I asked the lady, "What's that up there?" And she said, "Oh," she said, "that's one that just cries, sleeps, and eats. And the milk runs out of its mouth." And I said, "Well, can I see it?" And she said, "Why, sure." She said, "It's probably sleeping now." So she took it down, and I looked at it, and I turned it over, and it had a little mole on its little behind shaped like a star. And that I fell in love with, and I said, "I'll take this one." And it was you. And I brought you home, and I have liked you ever since. And she was asleep by then. 2 weeks later, I got a note from the nursery school that she was in. "Please tell your child the truth where she came from, because I've got shoe boxes back here in this room, and they're going back there looking for babies. But she's 18 years old now. Every time she gets a new boyfriend and we're sitting around talking, I've got to tell that story. Now, she will tell that to her own child.
The change really came when families no longer lived together. I mean, generations used to live together. And you couldn't protect yourself from the stories then, because I did have all of my experiences were not thrilling. My grandfather lived with us when I was a child, and I loved him very much, but he talked you to death. And he was strong on the storytelling tradition, but he just wasn't as talented at it as my father, and I would try to avoid it.
We don't take time to play with our children like we used, like the people used to do years ago when they didn't have all this, because they would get out there. That's how we learn these games, how we learn these songs, because they would teach them to us. They would get out there with us and play them. If you make a mistake in that game or try to mess it up, so hold up, wait a minute, young man. You either play that game right or you sit down. Or sometimes you get a whipping if you mess it up. Right. That's just how sacred and important those games and things was with those people.
That's right.
Take time to do this. Take the time.
There's so much pressure put on families to have both parents working that by the time they get home, and by the time they fix the meal, and by the time they do this, and by the time they do all the things.
The people who create oral literature appear to me to be people who meet the one condition that they have the time and opportunity, you know? So anytime you get places where there's people with a lot of time to spend together, that's when you start getting significant batches of oral literature.
I'd sit down in my father's barbershop waiting for him to take me home from school. At 3 o'clock, I would go to his shop and wait until 5 when he got off, and he would take me home. And for 2 hours, every single day, I heard people pouring stories forth.
Yeah, I guess I actually cut my first haircut when I was about 12. The older ones used to come down, and they would sit in the barbershop sometimes 2 or 3 hours. They wouldn't get a haircut except when they could sit and talk.
This guy went to the barber shop, and he says, sits in the chair, and the barber says, well, how you want your hair cut? Well, he says, I'd like a little chick here on the right side, says, sticking up. And he says, like a little hole cut on the left side. He says, just a little divot on the left side. He says, and in the back, he says, you can kind of leave two or three of them sticking out a little bit longer than the rest. The barber says, well, that's almost impossible to do. Well, he said, I don't see why. He said, that's what you did last time I was here.
They'd sit in at the old stove, and they'd be waiting for Ray to come in to get something going.
I worked here for my grandfather when I could just barely see across the top of the counter. My grandfather said, if you ain't got it, you can't sell it. And his slogan was, he had everything from safety pins to caskets.
That store was old, Geneva. And I traded down and tell jokes, you know, and Jack Tail.
They stayed and visited with their neighbors or talked to the traveling salesman that came in. On weekends, especially Saturday, was the big day when everybody came to the store to get their week's supply of groceries. Back before TV days, and they wouldn't have TV to go back home to, so they'd stay here and swap yarns. We had a big ash box down at the stove for them to spit their ambier in, and they did, and sometimes miss it, but that's all right.
I suspect that there is a whole genre of laundromat literature. You could just really clean up. If you pardon the unintentional pun.
It seems to me one of the critical things is that there is oral continuity. That is, that makes connection between people. That is where the transmission of values and the transmission of anything like wisdom will occur. It has built into it a revaluing of the elderly, who are always, you know, the preservers of wisdom and knowledge and experience. And it has built into it as well an empowering of local communities.
I grew up in this town. I mean, I drive past places downtown, and there's a history that goes with the places that I know. I mean, I know what was there before.
Rocks have stories. You know, you just sit down on a rock, and what you know is that 30 years ago you sat on that rock with your grandfather and rested a while. And so the rock contains that story. So trees, bridges, riverbanks, old buildings, you know, just hold the story. But it's up to the storyteller to know what the stories are, and then to find a way to externalize them so that they're available to the community as what I like to call a nourishing source. I think there is soul food in the memory and the retelling.
This ship went back to Africa and got these people, and they told them that we want you to come here to America to work.
Among the people, they brought 18 of the Igbo tribe people with them. Once when they got here and found out that they were going to be sold for slaves.
And they said, no, rather than to be a slave, I'd rather be buried in my grave and go home to my Lord and be free.
Then they link themselves together about the wrist with chains.
To keep anyone from backing out at the last moment.
They went down together and said a prayer.
They said, water brought me here, and water's going to carry me away. And they backed themselves out in the Atlantic Ocean into Dunbar Creek.
And backed out into the water and drowned themselves, singing,
oh, freedom.
And today it's a historical spot that they drowned themselves there on Dunbar Creek. It's called Igbo's Landing.
Hold on me, and before I be a slave, I'll be buried.
History of stories told to me. History of stories.
Yeah, I bet you there's a lot of rich stories right here in New Orleans, made up of the people who just don't have access, who see no images of themselves on television, who see no images of themselves in the books they read, and in the schools they go to and so forth, you know, in the textbooks as well as the... It's just not there, you know. So they do it themselves.
Their stories are what it's about to me. It's the Brecht, it's a Bertolt Brecht poem, you know. Who built the seven gates of Thebes, you know. When Caesar conquered Gaul, Brecht asked, was there not even a cook in the army, you know? When the Chinese wall was built, where did the masons go for lunch, you know? And here's the killer, you know, when the Spanish Armada sank, we read that King Philip of Spain, King Philip wept, and here's the big one, were there no other tears? Now that's what it's about.
When I was in Vietnam, there was one point there, when I was a squad leader by that time, like I'd been there about 9 months, I guess, and we were walking past this one hut. And like there was this odor that came out of it, and all of my squad would grab their nose and gag. And as I came by it, you know, like I smiled. It was bagong, you know, in the Philippines. It's the salted fish, you know, and they call it nukmam there, you know. And I smelled that, you know, I said, wow, you know. I went there and I traded my sea rations and I ate rice with them, you know. And it made me realize that You know, they use water, you know, water buffaloes, the same wheat as we do in the Philippines. They, you know, rice paddies. And when that little Vietnamese kid came up to me and said, same Viet Mi, because I was eating their food, made me realize that there wasn't that much difference. But I could not dwell on it. You know, I mean, I'm there in a life and death situation. I locked it away, you know. Continued being a Marine.
That's what the tape recorder can do. What oral history can do is get the story of Peggy Terry, the Appalachian woman, or Hartman Turnbull, the black guy, you know, or Eva Barnes, the packing house worker, and they're great storytellers.
If there's nothing else to take the place of their storytelling as a way of reinforcing their sense of community, then obviously the sense of community is going to deteriorate. We have lots of documentation to support the breakdown of the family, but I think you also have documentation to support the breakdown of the neighborhood and the community. And the emphasis more and more on the individual and a sort of alienation developing. And the inability of people to communicate with each other as effectively as they once did.
Why sit and look at old grandpa tell stories when you could look at Jackie Gleason make you laugh and act a fool and act it out in costume? And grandpa's just going to sit there in them old bib overalls and he's not interested. And we've heard them stories 100 times. But it's all new on television.
Thank you very much.
Excuse me.
Oh, for sure. I'd agree with that.
Thank you, Dennis.
You're welcome.
Believe it.
For horses and...
If there isn't a car crash or somebody slamming a door or a quick cut to something else, then it's not American. Maybe that's something inherent in American culture. Everything always has to be moving west, moving up, moving down, moving, you know.
The sudden cut to another shot. Boom. I guess the TV commercial is the key, becomes the basis of it. Get on in within a spree of time. Bang. So you got 2 minutes. I says, 2 minutes to me. I mean, I says, what, 2 minutes? A long time on TV. Not long for me, you know.
There is a definite trend towards reducing, condensing, and summarizing things. And I believe that's very dangerous. I think people will stop learning how to think. And when people stop learning how to think, anything is possible.
Television's taken over, especially in the mountains. I mean, you go down a road and every other house has a satellite dish, and that's their total form of entertainment. You can sit home on your satellite dish and watch 110 channels and not talk to anyone all day long. I mean, that's what it's coming to.
We live in such a fragmented society that the electronic media can't convey a sense of community cohesion anymore. You know, you get people out in the North Georgia countryside turning on their TV and watching Dallas or watching Miami Vice or watching Hill Street Blues. How much of that relates to their own culture, to their own community? Very little. I mean, they can find it entertaining. In a sense, it's instructive about a different type of society within the United States for them. But it certainly doesn't do much to reinforce their own community values.
Things go along business holds us together, but I'm not sure that affection holds us together much anymore. I think that American life is troubled in our time because of the loss of the thread, of the sense of continuity. Who knows anymore what the American story is?
Now I'm just a bartender, and I don't like my work, but I don't mind the money at all. I see lots of sad faces and lots of bad cases of folks with their backs to the wall. But
Word of Mouth was written and produced by George King for WRFG-FM, Atlanta, Georgia. Today you heard in order of appearance actor John O'Neill, folklorist Debbie Bays, performance artist Mike Fader, educator Elliot Wigginton, writer Gurney Norman, storyteller Connie Regan Blake, actress Angeline DuBois, folklorist John Burrison, writer Joe Carson, folklorist Charlotte Ross, archivist Charlotte Capers, musician Tommy Thompson, journalist Phyllis Harper, ballad singer Nimrod Workman, storyteller Alex Jouar, storyteller Jackie Torrance, legend teller Catherine Smith, barber Jimmy Turner, retired storekeeper H. Mast, storyteller Ray Hicks, folklorist Barry Ancelet, anthropologist Barbara Meyerhoff, singers Frankie and Doug Quimby, author broadcaster Studs Terkel, and ex-Marine Corps Sergeant Mel Esqueta. Funding for this series was provided by the Humanities Council's Endowments and Committees of Georgia, Alabama, Kentucky, Louisiana, Mississippi, South Carolina, and Tennessee, with additional funding from the City of Atlanta's Bureau of Cultural Affairs and the Georgia Council for the Arts. The principal humanities consultant for the series was Cliff Kuhn, production assistant Louise Bloom. I'm Walt Elder. Next week, in the concluding episode of Word of Mouth, we investigate the impact of the media and professional entertainers on the oral tradition to find out who is telling stories today.
To keep me from slipping away.
Cassette copies and transcriptions of this tape are available from WRFG-FM, P.O. Box 5332, Atlanta, Georgia, 30307.